superintendent.
I really have a lot of concerns about this war and the returnees from this war, the long run. First of all, I don't think the war in Iraq was just war, it was moral. And I said that to some general officers, and I get away with that. They don't get away with it nearly as long as long term. But war in Afghanistan, I think, is more morality. But what's happened in this war is the use of the reserve and National Guard is tremendously high. It's the highest use of the reserve components in World War II. To give you an example, I was briefed a couple of weeks ago by the Veterans Administration, and they have statistics that showed over half of the veterans who served in Afghanistan and Iraq were in the reserve component in the National Guard. At one time, the Christian Reformed Church had 5 chaplains in Iraq. 3 of the 5 were from the reserve component. And that meant they were away from their church for 16 to 18 months, which is a long time to be away. But I wrote 2 letters to every one of the pastors in the Christian Reformed Church, urging them to pay attention to the veterans that are in their congregations, and especially the ones that are involved in this war. And I received a lot of good responses, and one thing they kept asking me was to make sure I could get some resources to help them. So I've been in the process of trying to gather resources. But the unique nature of this war also is that the cost in dollars is a lot more than was anticipated by them. This is the longest war in our history, longer than World War II. And we thought it would be over very fast. And it wasn't, because we didn't really send much troops in. And the cost of maintaining all volunteer force is tremendous. And one of the unexpected consequences of the all volunteer army was an increase in marriage content in the force. When it first started, I was at Fort Carson, and kids were getting big bonuses when they enlisted. And then they would go to basic and advanced individual training, and they would get another bonus. And all the while in basic and advanced, they were really taken care of by the military. You got to take 3 hots and a cot, and that was all you really needed. So when they went home on leave, they would do certain kinds of things with that bonus money, and then they would show up at Fort Carson with a new pickup truck and new wife, usually chosen in that order, I think. And they expect the military to take care of them. So we were putting chaplains in tent cities, and they were dispensing chaplain and diapers as part of their ministry. So the cost of the war is a lot, and we didn't plan and budget, especially in the Veterans Administration, for the kinds of casualties that were going to be coming their way. And so that's part of the real problem with getting medical care for people. Modern medicine is so good, and so good on the battlefield, that we're saving people who, in other words, would have been killed. The time from a person being wounded to the time they get to the first treatment center in the country is usually less than an hour. And the time they get to that first treatment center in Iraq to the time they get to launch school in Germany is usually 1 day. They stabilize them very fast. We have all kinds of good equipment on the airplanes, and good nursing and doctor staff that fly in and out of the country, escorting patients in and out. And type of fighting is also unique. Most of it is in urban terrain, and there's no harder war fighting than fighting in cities. And so you get a lot of tension on the part of soldiers. They have a training area for what we call mount, which is military operations in urban terrain. And you walk down the street, and all of a sudden these targets pop up, and you have to decide whether you're going to shoot it, friendly or if it's an enemy, real fast. And our military training has gotten so good that the American forces on the battlefield are the most lethal forces we've ever fielded. In World War II, General Slam Marshall did a study, and one out of six soldiers fired their weapon with an intent to kill. And when I went to basic training, we had fixed targets, and if you missed, somebody back there would play Maggie's drawers for how many times you missed or how many times you got hit. And then when I went back to basic as a chaplain, they had all pop-up targets and all human silhouettes. So it was a much different kind of training. It's made our force much more lethal. The weapon of choice for the insurgents in Iraq and the more so in Afghanistan is the improvised explosive device. And they put those things on the side of the road, and they hit our track vehicles, and over half the casualties in Iraq are as a result of the IED. In Vietnam, most of the casualties were from small arms. And the IED not only destroys the tank, if it doesn't kill you, it rattles your brain. And so the signature wound coming out of the war is a traumatic brain injury. And so basically the medical community is dealing with three kinds of things, and they usually make three kinds of diagnoses, especially among behavioral kinds of disorders. One is that it's a pre-existing condition. That means you don't get anything. Second, it's PTSD, and then you get something. You get traumatic brain injury, then you get a little bit more, and you're guaranteed some kind of hospitalization. And so those are some of the real uniquenesses of the war. Post-traumatic stress disorder is it's big. And as an example, this was out of a paper a couple days ago. Iraq and Afghanistan battle injuries and deaths, number 81,361, up from 72,043 last January. Veteran patients, including those who don't seek care until they return home, shot up to 400,304 for the Veterans Administration. And when you couple that with the folks from World War II, the Veterans Administration is taking about 809,000 veterans from all wars. So their workload is really gotten high. Most family physicians that have not dealt with post-traumatic shock, and most of them have not dealt at all with traumatic brain injury. There's a very good hospital right across the street on the Beltline that's run by Hope Network that has been doing traumatic brain injury work for a long time. And I've been trying to get money free so that we could send some of the people from Michigan to that center. Then they made a decision recently that the Purple Heart would not be given to PTSD people. And one of the reasons they did that was basically money. Because Purple Heart gets you higher on the list when you go to a Veterans Administration. That little thing there is my Purple Heart. And that gives me precedence over most of the other people who go into the Veterans Administration, except another Purple Heart worker. So they estimate that people suffering from mild traumatic brain injury is up to 320,000 deaths without ever returning home. So that makes me concerned. And in the military, the safe haven or a safe portal is always a chaplain. We have privileged communication, confidentiality, and the troops alert the chaplain before they go to anybody else and get out of trouble. And I think that in soldiers' minds, that translates over to the church, too, that they see the church as a safe haven. We worship in sanctuaries. And I think that is part of what the young troops really look for. And so I think it behooves the church to be ready to do something for them. I went over and talked to your son John's folks at Worship Institute, and we sat down, the whole staff. I talked to them about some of my concerns and some of the things I did in my ministry. Like when soldiers were really angry, I would take them to some of the imprecatory psalms. Now I find out that there's no such thing as an imprecatory psalm. God's text correct, I think. But things like Psalm 108, I hope this guy's progeny disappears. And it really deals with some kind of anger. And I never heard a sermon in my whole life on the imprecatory psalms. So I started preaching a couple. And I did that in the military, and I had guys pray those, and also the prayers of lament. Because they're biological kinds of prayer. And what people who are really in distress want to do is they want to have a dialogue with God. Why in the world is this in my life? And the Jews are good at that. I mean, they have really good prayer. Walter Brueggemann gave a talk on being biological in a monologic world. And one of the problems with praise worship is it's monologic. And he said the churches have to recover the Psalms of Lament in order for us to once again begin to teach the whole business of doxology. But I asked John and his folks to put some stuff together, and they did. And you'll find them listed on the resources under the first two sites there. And they're really good. One of them is try to make your church becoming a veteran-friendly church. He says even pastors can do it. And the writer of that is a fantastic guy. He interviewed me, and he interviewed a bunch of other folks. Really laid out some really good stuff for pastors and councils and churches on how they can really become veteran-friendly. And I didn't get that reproduced because it was coming too many trees. And that's 6 pages, and you can all go to his web page and get it out, and then you have access to all of the things that he references in there. And then I sat down with Howard Vanderwall, and Howard and I spent a lot of time, and I went through my library and my files and picked out some stuff and brought them over to Howard's desk. And so he put together a thing on post-traumatic shock disorder and different kinds of cults. For instance, he had one where there's worship resources and congregational resources, psalms and prayers for those with PTSD, some suggestions for pastors, some denominational resources, and then a section on learning more about PTSD. And it's really a very well done document. I sent both of these to the three chief of chaplains of the services, and the Army Chief of Chaplains sent me an email at the end of the day saying, I've already used it 3 times, and I sent it out to all my colonels. And I briefed it the first week in January at the Department of Defense, and the Secretary of Joint Chiefs of Staff, 3-star general, was there, and he blew through all this great stuff. He had looked it up before he came to my briefing, so he had a full idea of what was all in there. And his brother's a chaplain, retired. And so he really thought that was great, and he recommended it to commanders, and so that all of the joint service chaplains now use it. So it's really a great resource. The study that was won by Rand Corporation on the invisible wounds of war, and when you read through that. And I read it mostly on the net, not in Tribal, but I did copy. And you really begin to see what happens to people under post-traumatic shock, and also the lack of resources that we have to take care of those. So those are some of the resources. And one of the things I kind of like to do is look at some others. For instance, I think it's helpful for a military person to have some idea that you understand what the military is like. And in one of the handouts that I gave that was done by my friends in the Methodist Church, they have a listing of some of the things that the military is unique about. And I remember when I went to take the training, we were doing a day where we were wearing pink and black, and we had our hair that was called the dark spine, and we just tucked it in. It was like a background of the dark spines of flying north. And you walk in, and they set you down and get your hair cut. And it says, how do you like your hair cut? I thought I'd just take a little bit off the side. And right down the middle. And then they give you a uniform, and on the uniform is your last name. And all of a sudden, you don't have a first name anymore. You're a Kaiser. And you lose it. Then every week, you go through a different kind of activity, and you learn how to do that skill. And so you're rewarded for your behavior every week. I was a little older when I got drafted, and so they made me an acting sergeant. And we went on bivouac, and it was terrible, wet, rainy stuff, and we had a miserable week. But coming back, we were sort of in route march, and we're getting near the barber shop, and there's a whole bunch of recruits standing outside of the barber shop. And the formation said, "Hey, Kaiser, call us out of route step and let us march and give us an eyes right when we get by the barber shop." So we started marching. I called cadence, and we got by the barber shop, and I said, "Eyes right." And everybody looked, because now they were soldiers, and those other guys were recruits. And this is 8 weeks into basic training. It's one of the most powerful rites of passage that I think we experience in our lifetime. And there's a saying, you know, you can take the soldier out of uniform, but you have to take the uniform out of the soldier. And I think that's true, because I don't know of any other organization that has as many alumni groups as the military. I get letters asking for money from the wounded veterans, the veterans from our international wars, the AMVETs, you know, veterans from Vietnam, all of that kind of stuff. And they're all over the place. And that's all of the alumni association. You have to have some place where you can tell the stories about war, and where people can sit there and understand what you're talking about, and know when you're telling the truth, when you're telling a lie, and let you tell your lies what you want. But one way to let people know about that, I think, is to preach on some of that stuff. I think the sounds of lament are tremendously powerful things for people who are coming out of the war. Because the psalmist, sometimes he really gets a case against God, and he brings it there. And you would be surprised how many soldiers were surprised when I would say, "Look, God's big enough to handle all of your anger. Just tell me you're angry. And he's big enough to take care of that stuff." "Oh, I couldn't do that." I said, "Well, read what the psalmist said." And then, is that in my Bible too?
Yeah.
So you want to look. Some other passages of scriptures, and there's some on the website, but I just looked at some. The story of David and Jonathan. I think that's the kind of bonding between soldiers that take place. They were both soldiers. You know, David says when Jonathan died, "I've never known a love so great, not even the love of a woman." And you think about that. Yeah, I think that's true. I saw it in Vietnam. Soldiers told one another things that they didn't tell their mother or father. And I used to write parents of the soldiers who were killed. "Your son didn't lie to die lonely. He died with a bunch of people who knew more about him than you did." And that was always a comfort to the parents. But I think that's the kind of thing where you move it out and just look at the fact that there's a kind of bonding that takes place in a military organization. And the reason people really fight wars is not for any national thing, but for the guy who's standing next to you. That's the guy you want to trust. Because that's the guy who's covering the backside, and that's the reason they fight. And you can look at a lot of literature on war fighting, and you'll find a lot of people saying the same thing. Another one, I think, is 2 Samuel, the story of David and Bathsheba. That's a great story. There's one little word in that story that is just fascinating, because it appears so many times, and that's the word send or sent. this takes of the story. David sent for Bathsheba. He got her. He sent a message to Joab, just so that he could get Uriah back. Uriah comes back and doesn't go sleep with his wife, so he sends him back to battle. And then Bathsheba sends word to David, hey, I'm pregnant. Joab sends word back to David, I did what you wanted, and Uriah is dead. And all of those words, in a pretty strong sense, has on a moral character. And the only two times that David knew he wasn't in control was when Bathsheba sent word that she was pregnant. And when Joab sent word back that Uriah was dead. But all of the rest of them, David sent. And then in my preaching the story, Nathan becomes the chaplain. And the chaplain comes and tells the king a story. His commander in chief tells him a story. And then you're the guy. And I think you look at the power of David as a military person and then the king, and really he begins to put himself in the place of God by the exercise of his kingly power. Another one is in 2 Samuel, where the Philistines are in Bethlehem, and David is outside of the city. And he says, oh, boy, I wish I could have a drink from Bethlehem as well. And three of his mighty warriors go down and get him water and bring him water at the risk of their own life. And that's the power of a commander. Just an idle wish. And when David sees that, it's just an idle wish. And he pours it on the ground as a libation to God because he couldn't drink it. And then you read the story about who these guys were. And one of them slew so many men, and that he, at the end of the day, when he was finished with the battle, he couldn't get his hand loose from the sword. And depending on what translation you read, some say it was frozen there. But I don't know about you, but I held on to something so tight that I had to go like this in order to make my hands open up again. Usually a golf club after a bad shot. But those are just a couple ideas out of the Old Testament. There's an interesting book War in the Hebrew Bible, and I have another one at home that talks about the battles of the Old Testament. And when I retire, I'm going to go through some of those battles, and then I'm going to send and get some maps and stuff and look at the weaponry they had and the kind of tactics and strategy that were used, and I'm going to send them to the American Bible Society so they can put them in the Bible that they hand out to soldiers, because I think soldiers would appreciate that and read it. In the New Testament, I think the faith of the centurion, if you look at what he says, you don't even have to come to my house. And I think behind that is a real acknowledgement of Jewish religious law. Don't come and be near someone who's dying. You have authority to just speak and it'll get done. And I think that that's another insight into one of the things that soldiers have to be very concerned about is understanding the faith of the people in their area of conflict. And my last assignment, the last two assignments, I did a lot of that. Another one is, in Romans, Paul says, we're more than conquerors. And what does that mean? When I used to do war planning when I was at European Command, after we get the battle plans all drawn up, I would say, okay, the battle's over, now what are you going to do? What's the end state you want to see? A lot of talk about exit strategy from Colin Powell. What was the exit strategy for Iraq? Didn't have any. So I used to say, the Bible says you're more than conquerors. Now you guys are that in that place. If the battle goes the way you described it, you're going to be more than conquerors. What does it mean to you? And we had some interesting discussions about that. and it was very difficult. And if you look at the literature coming out of the Department of Defense and the Department of Army, now they're calling it sustainment operation. And the first books that were written on sustainment operation were written at the end of 2003. And 2 weeks ago, the Army published its first field manual on the spectrum of warfare that includes sustainment operation. We really don't know what it means to go to war to bring peace, basically because we don't know what peace is. And I think that that's something that ministers should consider preaching about, because I think those are important things for people when they go into conflict. And, dealing with the government as an instrument of the government, you have to talk, I think, some about what happens and what are you going to do when you have to kill somebody in the battlefield. What would you say to a young soldier? The hardest thing I dealt with in all the hours in Vietnam was keeping the enemy clean. Because when I first got there, they were cutting ears off and sticking them on their belts. And I went to the commander and I said, you got to tell them to stop that. And he said, well, I'll try. But this is war, and it's easier to kill the enemy when you dehumanize. So I asked to talk to the troops in formation the next morning, and I said, you can have all other military gear for souvenirs that you want, but if there's any personal stuff, I want you to give it to me. And I'm going to collect it in a laundry bag. And when I get a bag full, I'm going to bring it to the International Red Cross in Saigon and ask them to send it back to North. They started doing that. And they stopped cutting off ears after 2 weeks because they began seeing, oh, this guy's got a family. He's got a wife and kids. He's a son. And all of a sudden, they became human again. But when they become human, then you have to deal with what happens when you kill another human being. But a lot different than saying, I just shot a target. And how does one love one's enemy on a battlefield? And I think one of the things that ministers and councils can do is talk about some of those issues with people before they go to combat. When they get there, it's too late. Mm-hmm. And the military is starting to realize that now. There was a PBS thing on soldiers of conscience that begins to look at some of those issues. And it was a young major who was at West Point who did a lot of work on that and started to convince the military that we really needed to talk about killing before we sent soldiers into war. I used to go when I was a basic training chap, and I used to go and make sure I was present every time there was bayonet training. Because that really gets rough. When you got that knife on the end of your weapon and you stick it in a target, and you twist and pull, and then you realize that you might have to do that to a human being. And a lot of guys walked over and wanted to talk to me when we were on the bayonet thing.
And we are.
Huh?
Aren't we? I don't presume American forces are saying the same as any British forces. Bayonets are being used in Afghanistan in a way that they have not been used since the First World War. Yeah. We've got trench moving forward, guys with bayonets drawn every day. That really. Because that's up close and personal. That's not, you never press the button and off it goes. It's, I can see it.
I go to a great Christian Reformed church, and after I sent that letter out, the minister, Stan Mass, was at the packet service on Sunday, and he went to this door where I was exiting, and he said, Kaiser, I got your message, and we're going to do something about our veterans, and I'm not going to involve you at all. I said, thanks, Sam. So, one of the pillars in the back in the narthex has the addresses and pictures of the men and women who are serving from Liberty Church. And every Sunday, on the insert on people to pray for, those service members are listed with their address. When they change stations, Everybody in the congregation knows that it can be taken. When they're deploying to Iraq, everybody knows. Easy. It doesn't take a lot of work. And it gets done really well. And I think it really makes the church aware of their service members. Gloria Cruz's son was with an IED and came back. And the church really became aware of what some of the problems were, because he had broken his heel and all kinds of stuff. Took a long time to heal up. And I told Gloria, I said, you gotta let him share that with the congregation. And they did. And we had two of folks come back from Iraq, and one was really concerned about what was going on over there, and another one was really a young Marines. And we asked them to share their story with the congregation during the adult Sunday school hour, and we filled the place. Almost everybody from both services were there listening to their story, and just to give them an opportunity to speak. I also think that sending someone away and receiving one back is very important. And in the handouts I gave you, there's my Methodist friends put together a service when you send somebody in a service, also when they come back. It's a good outline of some of the things you can do. What Stan started doing, and John, at the grave, was when somebody was leaving, they would invite them up, and they would say a prayer with them and put their hands on them before they left. And it was very powerful for the congregation. And that's just a simple little thing that you can do in the worship. And inviting them back, is acknowledge their back, ask them to come in uniform, and it makes a difference. People don't know what uniforms are much, because I've been asked at least six times today what service I've been in. And I thought everybody knew me with us. Another thing is support groups. If you have a lot of veterans, and a lot of people in the military or your church, you might want to start a support group. Or if you're close to another church that has a couple, you might want to try and get those people together. There's a really good one out in Rush Creek Bible Church. I brought them here for a call session after I found out, and I let Charlie Honey know, and Charlie Honey put them in the Grand Rapids Press. And so, but they had 15 young people in the armed forces, all young folks, and parents just wanted to get together and share some of their anxiety. You know, I haven't heard from my son in a week and a half. What's going on? And one of the other couples said somebody was probably wounded in his unit. When they do that, they go in blackout, so there's no communication. And that really eased the mind of that mother, who was really concerned because she hadn't heard from her son in a long time. And that support group did a tremendous amount of work with each other. They put packages together, sent things out, had the kids in the Sunday school write letters to the soldiers, took offerings. Peter Huffman, who was here at the conference, just got back from Iraq, and he did a great job, good young chaplain, Gloria Cruz's son-in-law. So she was a chaplain, she's a great chaplain. But he was working in a village, and he said, you know, what these villagers really need is some flip-flops. So I just put word out in the denominational building, you know, how many would like to bring in some flip-flops? And one of the directors wrote a check for $50, and I said, okay, I'll match it. So we sent about $300 worth of flip-flops to Peter, and he brought them to the village. Yeah, it was a Christian Reformed Church's denomination of buildings, gifts, in his ministry. And I used to put Lord Church's stuff on the, and send it up through the denomination so that everybody would get a copy of what Lord was talking about. And also, when the tsunami hit, one of our chaplains was on the leader, and Tom Walcott. He used to write back what he was seeing, and he would send pictures back. And
I just put them on the webpage and send them around, and Andy Reichkamp ate those suckers up like crazy because he was going to try and get money for CRWRC to help, and we had better pictures than anything. And then people say, well, what's a warship doing over there? And Tom sent me back a picture of the deck of that aircraft carrier, and they had real long spigots so they could put water jugs in. And they were filling water jugs and using the desalinating things on the Abe Lincoln, and then they would fly them by helicopter into the area, and there was no cholera breakout. Simply because that aircraft carrier was there dispensing clean water. A lot different than what happened in Rwanda, what's happening in Broadway today. The sacraments, I think, is something that you can talk about with people, especially families that are going. When I was a chaplain, I would have a baptism. I would ask the couple what church they belong to back home. And I would pick up the phone and call the pastor or send them a letter. And I said, I would like to ask your permission to represent your church in baptizing this infant. And I think I was the only chaplain who was doing that. But the response from the ministry was tremendous. And they would say, I want to send something that you can read at that baptism. It just really was magnificent. You know, and what we believe about baptism is that, you know, if we do it for the church, and, you know, here's his church, or her church, is participating in that baptism in Germany when they're on the west coast of the United States. And communion. All of a sudden, you're in a communion service, and everybody gets up and goes to the rail. And you have never done that before. You don't know what to do when you get up there. You know, and I've been in services that have been like 3 million services because there was a Missouri Synod Lutheran chaplain who was running the service, and Missouri Synod can only serve in those who believe in the real presence. So half of the rail was for those. And then the other half was for those who believed other than the real presence. And then the ushers passed communion out to the pews, too. My dad and mom said, this would go over like a Led Zeppelin on a Christian born church. So, but what I try to do is when I identify resources, I send them to the worship, and I also put them on my webpage. And my webpage is just go to Christian Reformed Church and look for agencies and hit agencies and see chaplaincy ministries. And every time I find one, I put it in there. Because I know that's my job. And if I can make your job easier by putting some of the stuff up there, that's all there. I really think that you have to take a little bit of a long view, too, with some of the folks coming back. They give psychological tests to people coming right out of combat. And if they're staying in for a while, at 3 months point, they get that same test over again. And what the Army has been finding out is that the 3 month part, they're much more psychologically damaged. And that psychological damage is being acted out in their lives in very, very different ways. So here's somebody who's home 3 months, and you forget that. And there and back, and all of a sudden he's starting to beat his wife. All of a sudden he's acting in a strange way. One of the things that I got both eyes done with for cataracts this year, or last year, and I got 20/20 vision, but now I got to put these things under me. For the first time in my life, I ever drove my car without glasses. And I kept going like this. So one of the major effects of minimal brain damage is due to a psychiatrist who works with veterans' families called an identity ambiguity. People who were decisive become indecisive. People who were charming become withdrawn. She sees soldiers who left a good son, a good father, and a good husband suddenly start hitting their children, can't have sex, start drinking too much, talk too loud. And I think this is an interesting line. Like a stone thrown into a pond, this behavior ripples out to the family, friends, and coworkers. There is a 70% chance that relationships will break down after a person suffers from traumatic brain injury. I find those scary kind of statistics. And I think the church has been called by God to look at some of this stuff and to offer to be wounded healers in the midst of our community. So I want to leave some time so we could have some discussion, because I don't know if I covered what you wanted me to cover or not. So.
I just a quick comment on the question. You talked about the narthex pillar at the grave. I'd like to expand on that just a second and say that two people of the church I currently serve took upon themselves to do research about everybody in the church who has ever served in the military and created a Memorial Day bulletin board and even asked widows of former service people to submit a picture and let us know where these individuals served. That was an incredible moment when that was revealed, and the number of people and people that you would have long forgotten ever served. Some will still bear the marks of war and the injuries they carried. But what an instruction to the younger half of the church to see how many of the older men, mostly, were active in the military. So just an idea. And what was a bulletin board of between 40 and 50 people in our relatively small church now is a wonderful notebook in the library that anybody can access, and we hope to keep that current.
I think it's a great idea. A couple of other churches I've been at have done a two Lee Street, I think, of it. Lee Street has a big service every Memorial Day. And another one of the churches, just outside of Grand Rapids a little bit, they have it too, and they keep that up, and they kill it every Memorial Day. And it's really fascinating to see all the names. And a lot of churches are all kind of related anyway, so when you really help Dutch Bingo, you start looking at who all the churches are doing and where.
They said the service on Memorial Day, is that on Memorial Day or the Sunday before?
Sunday before.
Sunday before. We deal with sensitivities to, it includes things like patriotic hymns. And we've worked up a statement that said when you deal with patriotic hymns or other issues such as that, that is appropriate, but it must always be clear, if I can quote the sentence note, clear that the purpose of our presence is to worship God and not to honor individuals. Do you have any insights on how to recognize individuals and yet make it clear that this is a service where we're worshiping God? I have been in the churches, services that it seemed like, both on 4th of July, the Sunday closest to Veterans Day, that it was a service that was honoring the individual more than worshiping God.
I think you have to do a delicate balance between those. And, some of our churches don't have flags and fly the national standards because they don't want that kind of thing into the worship. I think the services that I've been in where they've done this kind of thing has always centered on, these are some of the gifts that God has given us and opportunities to serve a country where we have freedom to worship. And we should be thankful that that God has given us men and women who are willing to make a sacrifice so that we can have the kind of freedom we enjoy. I think we take so much of that for granted. If you look at what happened in Kenya, look at what happened in Zimbabwe with election time,
and then look at what happened in the United States over election time. And if somebody not thankful for that peaceful transition of power, then I'm sorry, you really don't know how to put together.
Just a quick response and then a very particular question. I had the same kind of struggle in the sense of with weddings. You know, people talk about the wedding, oh, that's the bride's day. Well, you know, you're getting married in the church, this is a worship service, so everything about it has to be a worshipful. Well, I know one of the things, like when we have sung God Bless America in my congregation, I always introduce it by saying, let us sing this song in a true spirit of prayer, that this really is a prayer for the blessings of God. And sometimes the words that the pastor speaks from the pulpit in introduction two songs like that, and even like America the Beautiful, where we say God shed his grace on you. It can be seen as praise. And the particular question that I have is, early in December, one of our Sunday school teachers came to church so excited that she had this address, and we were all going to send Christmas cards to the veterans in the hospitals. And then one of the other teachers said, well, I read on the internet that they're not accepting any Christmas card that's addressed to any soldier. As soon as they get them, they're throwing them out because they're afraid that there might be something in there. Do you have any light to shed on that? Are veterans hospitals still accepting things that are addressed to any soldier?
I think the veterans are for that. But they weren't accepting them in their lives for a long time because they were just getting inundated with cards. And so they just said, oh, we're not going to deliver any soldier mail anymore. But when I find something like that, I usually try to put it on my webpage. And if it's something that I think needs to go in the church bulletin, I'll put it in the bulletin announcements that we send out from Pentagon Midwest. And that usually gets to the pastors so that they know. For instance, I got a lot of calls about what should go into a package that you want. So I got all the stuff and put it on my website, which is some kind of thing that we can really use and send to the troops. And some of them, it's surprising, you know, the stuff that they shoot that looks like foam, they love it because it shows up all the booby traps.
Oh, the spray string thing, yeah.
And when I first heard that, I said, what in the world do they want that stuff for? And so I sent a note to one of my captains. They use it to identify where all the booby traps are, where all the wires are. And it's great, you never know.
Thank you. Just wanted to see if we could just share a little more on the colleagues about injuries and the effect on families as well. And the shop, just been doing some debriefing work with my colleague who's been in the Centre for Defence Medicine in London, which is the second phase. So often we repatriate through Germany and then back into this hospital. And that doesn't happen that often, but we have huge numbers of wounded soldiers coming back comparatively, so it was 4-1 to deaths. And that moment when the girlfriend or boyfriend, for a fleeting moment, or perhaps for longer, was thinking, actually, it'd have been better left in that sand for another half hour, because at least then we'd have a funeral. Because these are extreme injuries often people are coming back with. I mean, that's the extreme end, but even so, you know, you're thinking you're going back to your partner and actually, you know, he's left his legs in the desert.
Yeah.
It's that care for it moves very rapidly from the, you know, John's come back to, I don't know how to handle this, and that, as you say, ripples out with the kids and the care and support that actually the soldier often has got the institutional care of where he is, and we have to help support the wider family.
I was wounded twice in Vietnam, once in Cambodia when we had a rocket and mortar attack, and that's a story all by itself, but the rocket landed right outside of
a whole lot of sleeping in, pulled my flag back away, and the air went out of my air mattress, and I had some shrapnel wounds. But I borrowed a young lieutenant's flak jacket. But I was sleeping naked because I was being cross-shot, and I didn't put anything on. So I did put on a flak jacket and had a 45 on it. And I'm not supposed to carry a weapon. And I dragged a couple of guys who were wounded to the docks tent and did a cut down on the tracheotomy by flare light. Soldiers in the SS back of the head walked on. And when everything was done, I walked down into the tactical operations center, and the sergeant major starts giggling. And I said, "Sergeant, what's so funny? You should see what you look like, Captain." You know, he held a mirror in front of me, and I had blood coming out of my nose and ears. I was covered with blood, and I was stark raving naked except for a flak jacket. And what if I was glad he didn't take any pictures, I'd still be faking. But then I went out of the helicopter 150 feet. Pilot made an error and hit high tension layer and the rear rotor blade went on. And I was sitting with my feet out because we were going into a supply drop and I was going to do a memorial service. And so without the rear tail rotor, the helicopter was like this. And I was spun out. And the pilot told me when I was in the hospital, he said, "I looked at my altimeter and I was at 170 feet. And I saw you go under the bubble," and I said, "Oh my God, it was my chaplain." And I hit elephant grass and both the wrists, the ulna, the elbow, the humerus, dislocated this, both the shattered this, dislocated this, and broke this. So I spent I spent 5 months recuperating from those with different surgeries and stuff. But I was in Great Lakes Naval Hospital, and I had instant credibility when the Navy chaplains who hadn't seen combat would push me down to talk to the Marines who were amputees and stuff. You know. I mean, they tell the story before I get there, so I became a miracle chaplain. And here's a strange confession to say, like, "Boy, your boss is really taking care of you." But I walked in, and the Marines were playing chess. And one of the Marines who had lost both legs had been a good athlete, and he did not want to see me get CMC. And the staff worked with them. I noticed them playing chess, and in my head, Marines and chess didn't resonate too much. So I watched the way they were playing chess, and they were just really playing rough chess. So I asked the chaplain to wheel me over to this kid, and I'm going to play him chess. And he said, "Yeah." So the first game, we just knock him down, drag him out. And the second one, I started using a lot of strategy. I set up some traps for him. He says, "You know, you're just like the VC. What do you mean, like the VC?" And he started telling some of the story that he had experienced. And within an hour, he had divulged more to me over at Chipboard than he had said to the clinical staff in the time he was there. And when he got finished and he told me all that stuff, I said, "I think you're fiancé.
I'd love to hear that.
You're what?"
We ever cried together? They got together and got married in your church.
You know, when you're around people who are hurting, and you know what that's like. You know, when my mother died, the people who were most comforting to me were the people who had been in those moccasins before. And they came up and they didn't always tell me what a great mother I had. And they just embraced me. And, you know, Jim Cook has a book where 98% would just be there, just showing up. And I think that's right. I don't think there are a whole lot of church down here and stuff. I think just letting people know you care and letting them know what the possibilities are. I have some PTSD, and when I first got back, it was the worst. I went and got some counseling. But I found myself when I was reading some of the stuff from some of the chaplains coming out of Iraq, all of a sudden the dreams started coming back, and I was going out of the helicopter again. And the dreams had changed, but they came back. So I went back into counseling. Nobody escapes war without some injury. And I think I think you have to realize that if you're going to be a pastor for all of them, because they all are injured in some way or other. You can't see that, and we have made war so antiseptic on TV. I mean, Sergeant Ryan was probably the most graphic one with the first scene going on to Omaha Beach. But what's missing is the snow. I mean, you don't smell the blood. You don't smell the cordite. None of that stuff is there. And that's the kind of stuff that you don't smell the rotting body. And so war is not pretty.
PTS comes from some of the things we can't do as well. My colleagues, captains and colleagues, still suffers from time in Bosnia when the mandate was protect food trucks, and that's all. So you're sitting talking to, you know, some 12-year-old Yugoslav with a weapon while his pals are throwing people out of tower blocks. Your mandate is, unless he attacks this grain,
the wars of insurgency are terrible because you don't know who your enemy is. I mean, I remember in Vietnam riding in a truck behind another truck that was loaded with soldiers, and a 10-year-old girl threw a grenade, and the grenade blew up and killed the soldier that wounded, and one of the guys standing next to me reflexively hooked up his weapon and shot her. Then he walked over and looked at the fact that he had shot a 10-year-old girl. And that was really disheartening. But she was the enemy. But you don't rationalize that stuff away. So, and in this war, too, there's a lot of stuff that goes on. There's civilians that are killed, soldiers have to see all that stuff. And getting blown up by a bomb is not pretty.
Do you have any suggestions just in terms of pastors with people who are right now old, like World War II? Who are old. I mean, they're ill, getting old, many have died, but they're going to be, or Vietnam, or Korea. I mean, they're getting older.
Yes,
I mean, in terms of taking the initiative to talk about, I just not personally, but know somebody who didn't talk about his experience of liberating a German concentration camp until he was 80.
Well, I talked to the agents doing interviews with all the World War II veterans and whatever spouses they would want through the archives, and also the Library of Congress has an oral history program. And here in Grand Rapids, it's run by Grand Valley State University. They're taking all of those things. And I introduced Dr. Postman, and those of you who are old enough can remember the Uncle Dick from the Young Calvinist was his son, and we started talking, and he had been a doctor, white doctor serving a black unit, and he started talking about what that experience was, and we had good rapport. I mean, really, it was a marvelous interview, and so we gave him a copy. He took it and played it for some of his friends. They all wanted copies, and then he played it with his kids. And my wife Artis called up to talk to his wife because he had made the check out to LaGrange instead of me. And so he said, all the kids were here over the weekend, and we sat for 3.5 hours. And when they wanted to stop to test the tape to ask that another question, they would do that. So I suppose I'd love to have a copy of that conversation. Because she was even telling a family thing that they never told him before. And it's a great way to do it when you say you're going to do it. And I had another one of guys who was on a second wave going into the Philippines. And he said, I really didn't do much. And so we started talking. And I said, well, what was it like knowing that you were going to be the next group going on shore? And you were seeing all of this stuff happening. What did that mean to you and to your troops? And he began to describe the atmosphere, how the atmosphere changed on that troop ship after they were observing that. And who was in that Commission's interview, and he suddenly realized he had done a lot more than he ever realized he had done for himself and for some of the other folks who were living on the ship. And I, you know, most of the Bible that we have are stories, narrative. And when I did my work for my doctorate at Columbia University Teachers College, the way you transmit values is through the narrative story. And I think that's absolutely true. We tell a story and we communicate our values.
So, Earl, in response to Terry, I think I hear you saying that we would do these people a pastoral favor if, over a cup of coffee, we would just get them talking, because so many of them haven't talked.
Right? Yeah, and I think as they get older, you know, I think they're more willing to talk about it. And I find that many of them are really experiencing the pain that the young people in the church are experiencing, and want in some way to embrace the young people. And, you know, the Vietnam War was kind of an anomaly in a lot of ways. I mean, when Vietnam veterans see one another, they still say welcome home to one another. And whenever I'm in an airport and some young soldiers get off in uniform, the first guy to stand up and applaud a Vietnam vet. And if you read through that one book that I have, Achilles in Vietnam, one of the things that psychiatrist found was the tremendous feeling of betrayal on the part of the American soldiers in Vietnam. Now, it's true. The AK-47 was better than the M-16. The M-16 jammed like crazy. The AK-47, you could stick that thing in the garbage dump. It's still firing. And one of my guys stood up and went to fire because he saw some guy in ambush. The weapon misfired. He got killed. And his buddy just went on the rampage. He emptied four clips into the 2DC. But I think telling the story is a way of healing. That's what catharsis comes from. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.